I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Today on Change Surfer, we'll be listening to the second part of a speech by science fiction author and e-rights activist Cory Doctorow, delivered on February 18, 2006 at the Boscone SFCon in Boston, Massachusetts. He talks about the global legal and technological efforts to lock down digital rights and restrict personal and creative use of electronic materials. Cory contributes to the phenomenally entertaining blog Boing Boing at boingboing.net, writes for numerous publications, and is the former European Affairs Coordinator for the Electronic Freedom Foundation. He is now a fellow of the EFF. His most recent novel is Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. Cory's website is crapound.com. You can download the first part of his speech from the Change Surfer Radio page at IET.org.
Digital rights management is also not a contract, because a lot of people say, well, maybe you would contract out of the right to sell something in exchange for the right to get it at a cheaper cost. But when we look at the way that these contracts work, they tend to be pretty freaky, right? You get these long, long screens of legalese that have all kinds of terms that no sane person would ever agree to. For example, the Sony DRM CDs that got them in so much trouble from Halloween to Christmas last year, they included terms in their license agreements. An agreement here, to call it an agreement is an insult to agreements, included things like, if you go bankrupt, you'll delete your music. You can't play your music at work. If you leave the country, you have to get rid of your music. If your house is burgled and you manage to keep a copy of the music on a backup drive, you have to delete that backup, and so on, right? These are funny and weird agreements. It's kind of like saying, well, you know, I've agreed to this and I didn't even know it, and it's pretty rough. And I actually spoke to a representative for the Motion Picture Association at a standards body meeting about this. He had proposed that we could have a system where television shows could signal to receivers which outputs they could be output on. So this one can go to a DVD recorder, this one can't. This one can go to your PVR, this one can't. This one can go to this kind of screen, this one can't. If you actually get a standard DVI monitor, which is a kind of computer monitor, and plug it into most set-top boxes, the Comcast boxes, you'll see a screen that comes up, a blue screen that comes up and says, this display is not authorized for use in connection with this programming, for most programming. That's what he'd proposed. And I said, well, you know, maybe when you sign up for cable, you make an agreement to waive some of these rights, but surely we have like common law and statutory rights in respect of free-to-air television, the stuff that's broadcast over the air, because those airwaves belong to us. We give them for free to broadcasters in exchange for entertaining us, and they shouldn't be saying, well, we're going to use this free thing that you gave us to lock you out. And he said, you're right, but maybe you could waive those under a contract. Maybe you'd make an agreement to waive it. And I said, well, tell me how that would work, right? Because that sounds reasonable. I believe in contracts. I've made all kinds of agreements where I give up some rights in exchange for some benefit. And he said, well, maybe you're watching Channel 3 and you pick up your remote and you change to Channel 4 and make an agreement. And I said, well, that's a funny kind of agreement. That's like walking into a shop and having the shopkeeper deck you. And you say, what the hell did you do that for? And he says, well, if you look under the doormat of a different shop, you'll see a license agreement that says that when you come into my shop, I get to punch you in the mouth. But even if that is an agreement, these systems increasingly and soon, I think, inevitably include something that in true Orwellian fashion is called renewability. And what it really is revocability. It's the ability for the system to update itself, to change the agreement. If you own a TiVo set-top box that records video, you got an update, a non-optional update before Christmas, that installed a new use restriction system for Macrovision that enables a broadcaster to flag his programming to dictate whether your TiVo can record it and then whether how long it can store it for, 24 hours or 7 days. Now, when you bought the TiVo, it was a device that could do a lawful thing, which is record everything on the air. It is no longer a device that can do that lawful thing. It now can only record everything that's on the air that doesn't have a flag set that says no recording. Right? That's a right that you acquired when you bought the TiVo that you lost as the TiVo progressed. right, as the TiVo went on. If you bought an iTune at version 4.0, when version 4.01 came out, which was a eventually became a non-optional upgrade, if you upgraded the operating system, you had to upgrade your iTunes too, you started off with the right to stream your music from any computer to any other computer. So I left my music on my computer at home and streamed it to my computer at work. You ended up with the right to stream it to any computer on the local area network, right? You had the right, you lost it. Or you had the right to stream your music to any five computers, and now you have the right to stream it to any five computers per 24-hour period, right? All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. This kind of revision, this kind of progressive tightening on the noose is what's characterizing revocability. How are we doing for time here? Good. And finally, as I said, digital rights management can't be an open source technology, because it treats the user as the attacker, and you can't implement it in open source. There are several legislative initiatives to sneak digital rights management into Congress, to make digital rights management occur without you noticing it, and therefore voting for someone who won't break your TVs. One is called the Broadcast Flag. And the Broadcast Flag is an initiative that says if you want to build a digital television receiver, you need to assure the people who control most of the rights, which is to say Motion Picture Association member companies, that all of the outputs and recording methods meet with their approval and won't unduly disrupt their business models. And what that means is that the device has to be built in such a way that a user can't modify it, and anything that plugs into the device has to likewise be built according to those terms. So when you go to the studios and you say, I've built a device with this kind of output, they want to know how you're going to lock that output and who you're going to give permission to, so they get to control all the people that you're going to give permission to plug into that output. And then they also want to know who's going to plug into that device's outputs. And then they want to know who's going to plug into that device's output. So that if that worked, it would pretty much take care of not only digital recording, but free and open source software, because all components, hard drives, video cards, and so on, would be built to resist user modification. And manufacturers would change their designs if users figured out how to modify them, and might even sue users, as they've done. Apple is now suing or using takedown notices to go after hobbyists who figured out how to take their Macintosh operating system and run it on an x86 computer, an Intel computer. All they're doing is running their code on another computer. They're not indiscriminately copying it for their friends. They're running the software they bought on a different computer in their house, right? And Apple's using that to shut people out. So that's what the broadcast flag does. Now, the broadcast flag wouldn't be sufficient in and of itself. It needs a second component, because anything that's transmitted in an encrypted format or given to you in an encrypted format has to be rendered unencrypted at some point. It has to be rendered, what we say, in the clear, so that it's intelligible and we can watch it. If I give you a copy of Star Wars Episode 1 on a DVD without a mechanism for decrypting it, I may have done you a small mercy, but in the end, all I've done is deliver you a drinks coaster, right? I have to give you a mechanism for rendering it intelligible. So, when it is being rendered intelligible, you can point a device that converts those analog signals back into a digital signal at it. You can plug something into the analog outputs, you can point a camcorder at it, you can capture that information. And that's what the entertainment industry, who generally are more media savvy than this, they call it the analog hole. I like to call it either the A-hole or the anal hole. I can't believe that an industry as media savvy as them has come out with a proposal to plug the A-hole, but they have, in fact. And their proposal to plug the A-hole is that every device that's capable of performing an analog to digital conversion, that is to say, taking analog and turning it into digits, which is like everything, right? I mean, my phone does it, my laptop does it, my iPod does it. I'm sure that there's probably an ADC somewhere in my camera, or in my watch. My camera certainly has one, and so on. All of these devices capable of performing an analog to digital converter will have to have something that detects what are called watermarks, which are these notional invisible marks that you bury in the signal that would instruct them as to whether or not they were allowed to record it. Now, this is nuts, right? First of all, the technology they've proposed for this is something called Veil. No one will tell you how Veil works. The only way you can find out how Veil works is to take a license from the Veil company, charges you $10,000 and makes you sign a non-disclosure, and all they tell you is how Veil decoding works. They won't tell you how Veil encoding works, and they want this to be a law, right? Veil's only field trial to date, its only use in commerce to date, has been in a Batman toy. Right, so people who make watches are going to have to implement a technology that's current, whose only current shipped field test is in Batman toys. madness. But even if it did work as intended, the unintended consequences of this would be dramatic and disastrous. Like, you're filming your child's first steps, he walks past the television, your camcorder goes dark. Right? That's the outcome of watermarks that signal to devices whether or not they're allowed to record, of ambient space that signals whether they're allowed to record. Now, that said, it still wouldn't be sufficient to stop people from getting outside the DRM lockbox because, of course, while DRM makes it expensive to make the first copy, all subsequent copies are essentially free, right? You have to be a super genius to like figure out how to break the lock, but you can be a complete idiot and figure out how to type into Google Star Wars Episode 1 space torrent, right? So in order to make that work, you need to shut down the ability of the internet to transmit this stuff because DRM never coerces people into doing the honest thing. You're sitting there with a mouse in your hand and you can click on the Kazaa icon or the iTunes icon. The iTunes icon gives you the same music as the Kazaa icon, except it costs 99 cents and you can only play it on Apple devices and it comes with a bunch of restrictions on your liberty, right? Well, that never incentivizes people to do the honest thing. People who buy iTunes do it because they don't know about the restrictions or because they're holding their nose and doing it, not because it's there. No one woke up this morning wishing for a way to do less with their music, right? No product can be sold by writing on the box now with fewer features, right? So they need a mechanism to shut down, essentially, the internet. Right, to turn the internet into AOL, where there's control points all through the network. Well, there's a proposal to do this. At the World Intellectual Property Organization, which gave us the DMCA, there's a proposal for a new standard for what's called intermediary liability. That's the liability that people who host web content and provide web access face for their users' actions. It's not clear that there should be any intermediary liability for this. Like, imagine you were wearing a Mickey Mouse giving the finger t-shirt and you walked into a restaurant, right? Well, the restaurant is displaying the trademark infringement, right? They're letting you display the trademark infringement. No one would sue the restaurant over your t-shirt. But we expect ISPs to police their users in just this way. You post your fanfic to your ISP is held liable for what you do unless they avail themselves of what's called a safe harbor. And that safe harbor says that when you get a notice that someone is infringing using your equipment, you have to expeditiously shut them down. And then if they dispute the accusation, you can put them back online again. Now, this has been a disaster for free speech. The Church of Scientology uses it to shut up their critics all the time. Diebold used it to stop whistleblowers from distributing memos showing that they defrauded the federal government in providing voting machines. Right? They said, that whistleblower memo, it's true, but it's a copyrighted work. Right, and you know, we commission that copyrighted work, that email that one of our employees sent to another employee that's been leaked all over the internet. That's a copyrighted work. You have no basis for distributing it, and they use takedown notices to shut people down. The thing about takedown notices is they don't work against peer-to-peer because peer-to-peer content isn't hosted. It's on your own computer. So what do you do if you get a notice, you're an ISP, and you get a notice, and you say, someone at the end of your DSL line is hosting a copy of Star Wars Episode 1? How do you shut that down? Do you ring them up and you say, okay, now click on your desktop. Do you see my shared files? Right, now go through there and you'll have a file that says 03 Star Wars Episode 1 .divx. Can you delete that for me, please? Right? And what if they say no? Or what if they say, well, I'm running an open wireless access point. I'm not hosting this. Someone within 300 feet of my house is hosting this. Right? Notice and takedown is ineffectual. What they propose is to replace it with something called notice and termination. The way notice and termination works, as you may have guessed from the name, is you get notice and you terminate the customer's access. Now, that sounds a lot like notice and takedown, the difference being that putting content on the web and taking it off the web costs approximately nothing. Connecting someone to the internet via a DSL line takes about 3 years to recoup in the most extreme case and about 1 year to recoup in the least extreme case. So ISPs that are forced to terminate their customers will go broke. Right? We get crap flooding of takedown notices now, where you get thousands of takedown notices being generated by software. You know, university professors whose surname is Usher, who post their lectures on their web server, usher.mp3, get takedowns from Usher, the band's label, right? Because they don't bother downloading it and listening to it. They just take it down and then they have to go and argue with the university and get it put back up again. But a termination regime would just knock ISPs out of business if you got these thousands of things. So I asked the MPA rep, how do you expect this is going to play out? Because it'll break the backs of the ISPs. And he said, it's simple. They will police their users to ensure that they never get the termination notice. What they'll do is they'll throttle your upload rate. They'll filter which ports you can use. They'll use deep packet inspection to figure out what protocols you're using, and they'll use protocol filtering. They will block anything that looks like it might result in an infringement to ensure that no infringement occurs. right? It's like confiscating all the printing presses to ensure that no one commits a libel. And that, I think, is the third piece of the puzzle. And when you look at the entertainment industry's reports to Congress, these senatorial content protection status reports, if you just Google content protection status report, it'll come right up. That's essentially what they say. We need to have a broadcast flag, plug the analog hole, and stop the scourge of peer-to-peer. And that outcome is a disaster. It gets worse because some of the restrictions that they want to add, as I mentioned, bootstrap this monopoly into completely new realms. For example, there's something called the authorized domain proposal, which says that a rights holder should be able to signal content as only being distributable within one household's worth of devices, which of course raises the question, what's a household? If you live in an MIT geek house, is that a household? If you're someone's dad who gets stuck in an old folks' home, is your ward a household? If you're a part of a diaspora population, a Filipina domestic working at a hotel in Boston whose family lives in Manila and whose brother is a construction worker in Saudi Arabia, are you part of a household? Well, given the way that these technologies have been developed to date, you're not. But I'll tell you who is in a household, someone who owns a summer home, right? They have figured out how to accommodate the summer home. They haven't figured out how to accommodate the Filipina domestic worker, right? Because they're designing the technology for themselves. They're designing these restrictions for themselves. Perhaps the most disturbing thing that I've ever heard in connection with the authorized domain has been a discussion where I said, "Well, what happens if you're the child of a divorced couple and you have joint and your parents have joint custody and you go from household to household every week?" And this would surely look like an attack, right? People ferrying content out of one network and into another. And he said, "Well, we already deal with that with Windows XP activation, right? You get a copy of Windows XP if you've ever been unfortunate enough to activate a copy of Windows XP. Sometimes you punch the serial number in and it says and it looks up the serial number and it goes." There's something funny going on maybe here. Like the last time this was activated, it was here, and now it's in Nigeria, and yesterday it was activated somewhere else. This probably isn't someone like reinstalling from a backup. This may have leaked onto the public internet. And you have to call an 800 number and disclose the circumstances of your install in order to get the software installed. Well, that may or may not be a fair thing for Microsoft to do with its customers. These are legal mandates. And a legal mandate that requires children to call up customer service centers and explain the circumstances of their parents' divorce in order to watch television is crazy. So we killed the broadcast flag several times. We did it by convincing lawmakers that the public were watching. The initial bit at the broadcast flag came out of a thing called the Broadcast Protection Discussion Group. The private cartel meets in Hollywood at the Marriott just outside of LAX. And they initially had been promised by Representative Billy Tozen, the representative from the now submerged Ninth Parish in New Orleans, that that he would make a law requiring the FCC to implement this. And the outcome, though, was that we brought in, as EFF, brought in so many people who objected to this that when the report emerged, it was 20 pages long with 200 pages of dissenting opinion from people who thought it was a bad idea. And Tozen said, "I'm not going to touch this with a 100-foot pole. You just got to get the FCC to do this off their own bat." And the FCC did, because they're apparats. They're appointed bureaucrats. In 4 years, government will change. They'll be out of a job, and they'll need jobs in industry. If they do stuff that screws the public up but helps industry, then that's fine for them. Their incentives are aligned to make that happen. Lawmakers aren't. So instead, what we've had is all these kind of in the dead of the night attempts to re-implement the broadcast flag, riders on balanced budget bills, and so on. The latest is the Digital Content Protection Act, the DCPA, which includes the veil mandate and also mandates on digital audio recorders for digital radio. It's pretty nutsy. So if you go to EFF.org and click on the Take Action button, you can find a letter you can fill into your Congress critter to inform them that they're there. And we can get one step closer to killing the broadcast flag, which ultimately will require decapitating it, putting garlic in its mouth, sewing its lips shut, and burying it at a crossroads at midnight on a full moon. But we'll get there. You need to get involved with activist groups if you want to safeguard your future, if you want to get to the future that we envision so often in science fiction of technology enabling us to have more engagement with civic causes, more culture, more participation, a more fan-ish world. A world where we aren't mere consumers, you know, what Bill Gibson described as a double wide, or something the size and color of a baby hippo living in a double wide on the outskirts of Topeka with no mouth, who can only express its extremes of mute rage and lust by changing the channels on a remote or voting in federal elections, right? If you want to be not a mere consumer, an ambulatory wallet with a trough leading into your gullet, then you need to get involved in these causes. And so EFF.org is a great way to get involved. There's also the free culture movement here at MIT and Harvard. There's Creative Commons projects, and those of you who are fans of my work know that I've used this to sell crap loads of books. There are copy native business models, just as there were radio native business models that emerged. We don't need to cater to people who think that the future is one of bits where bits get progressively harder to copy, despite all appearances to the contrary. You know, that's the biggest tragedy of them all, is we will never save an industry that demands that bits be made harder to copy, right? That's not going to happen. Anyone who's watched bits since the first Whole Earth cards moving, or even the first piano rolls moving up into, you know, these things, knows that bits just aren't going to get harder to copy. So we can start looking for and rewarding those people who found business models that don't require that the world be broken in order to make the copy-proof bit. So I think we've got a minute or two for questions. I'm sorry I went a little longer than I'd hoped to because of the room shuffle, but thank you very much. Sir.
Given that the U.S. is about the only jurisdiction that's really showing much sympathy with this kind of legislation, is it a likely outcome that the rest of the world will continue to develop open source software and open source hardware, which is about to start happening, it's become affordable, and the U.S. will become a technological backward?
If only it were true that the U.S. was the only jurisdiction in which this was occurring. So there's two things counterbalancing that. One is that there's other industrial nations that are just doing it off their own bat, like the EU, which has passed the European Union Copyright Directive, the European Union IP Rights Enforcement Directive, and is now doing another one that allows the use of special anti-terrorist measures to prosecute people who infringe copyright, the EU IP Rights Enforcement Directive 2. So it's not the case that the rest of the world isn't doing this. Most of this stuff actually emanates from WIPO, the World Intellectual Property Organization, which is completely in the pocket of the United States, but it's a mechanism for twisting the arm of everyone else. Any country that signed on to the World Trade Agreement, the WTO TRIPS, has to sign on to something that means that they'll create all these enforcement regimes and so on. So any country that wants to export soybeans or steel has to come into this pool of people who have these regulations. And even the ones that hold out there, when they enter into free trade agreements with the United States, like Singapore, Chile, CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, the Sub-Saharan African Free Trade Agreement that they're entering into with the U.S., all of these contain accession to the WIPO treaties as a condition of entering into these trade agreements. So if only it were so that we could find a place where they could have this. In fact, it's often the case that developing nations have much more strict and ridiculous copyright rules than the U.S. does. They just have very lax enforcement. And the danger is that as soon as they sign on to something like the TRIPS through the World Trade Agreement, they're required to start enforcing the laws that they pass to appease someone. You know, in Kenya, it's against the law to take a picture of your television while it's on, right? They never, of course, that's never enforced, but what happens when they have to enforce it? Sir?
You mentioned there's a lot of takeout notices that basically have no merit in terms of the content people claim ownership of. Is there any precedent for people suing based on libel or defamation, saying you lied about the content that was going to seem like that was copyrighted for people and wasn't, anything like that?
The statute doesn't require you to assure yourself that works are infringing. It only requires that you the thing that you have to sign an affidavit about is that you represent a rights holder who believes that the work infringes on you. You don't have to show any proof, which is why the Church of Scientology has been so successful in using it to silence its critics. However, Diebold, who I mentioned, used this to directly take down hundreds and hundreds of copies of these whistleblower memos. EFF sued them and won a gigantic cash settlement for a new theory called abusive copyright. And I'm hoping we'll see more of that. I think that is a promising avenue. The problem with impact litigation, which is what this produces, where you try to set precedents, is it requires that you have not just a good fact pattern, right, not just a good case, but you also have to have a really good defendant. You need unimpeachable people. It's not that impeachable people don't also need justice, but courts don't find in the favor as reliably of people who for example, are making porn, who need the same protections as people who are making making mathematical presentations. So you need the Princeton professor. You can't go in to defend the pornographer in most instances, because the problem is if you lose, you set precedents against yourself.
So you talked about business models that actually support this future where copying is free. And
sure.
Sure, I downloaded your book to my iPod and gave you $20 because I felt bad about reading it. I felt it was good. What are those business models? What do you mind? If you would economically teach these people if we could find business models that help?
Sure. So Red versus Blue, for example, this short machinima film thing, I'm told by someone who tried to acquire them that those two guys are making $500,000 each a year. That's a coffee native business model. The people who made Jib Jab, the Jib Jab people who made the This Land video where George Bush and John Kerry sing This Land Is Your Land, well, actually, the people who inherited the rights to Woody Guthrie's music actually tried to sue them for doing this. Woody Guthrie, who wrote a song about how the concept of property is corrupt. When it was reused in a political context, we tried. But anyways, those guys are like bathing in money. There are filmmakers, there are musicians. The MySpace bands, where they're sending selling half a million or a million units of songs that you can actually download for free from the internet from the same place that you order the music. Are making money. That's a copy-friendly, copy-native business model. I think that, I talked about charisma and virtuosity. I think the new thing is conversation. I think that we started, one of the things that made virtuosity a saleable commodity was that it was hard to substitute for. It's very hard to find someone who makes you feel the same way that this virtuoso author or musician makes you feel. But it's not impossible. In fact, I think most of us would say that somewhere in the world there's someone who's making something that'll substitute for this. Anyone who's ever worked in a bookstore where you're out of stock on book one and someone comes in looking for it and you sell them book two knows that art is actually, if you have sufficient knowledge, if the search costs are low enough, substitutable good as well. And in lots of instances, it's wildly substitutable. Like, anytime we're talking about like wallpaper or motel room art or whatever, it's totally substitutable. And the search costs are in free fall, right? It used to be very expensive to find a substitute good. Now it's cheap. The one thing that's not substitutable is a personal relationship. So when you look at these very successful internet artists, and science fiction is replete with them, Neil Gaiman and Leon Miller and Straczynski and Warren Ellis and so on, what these people have mastered is the knack of appearing to carry on a conversation with a million people at once. They're not actually doing that, but it feels like it. And the reason that you get their stuff isn't just because it's good, it's because they're your friend, right? We talk a lot about how in the abstract people want artists to be paid. I think people don't want artists to be paid any more than they want plumbers to be paid. What people want is the people who are their friends to be paid, right? They want to see to it that the people who are in their tribe get paid. And, we understand that there's an attenuated sympathy, that your it goes like sort of your lover, your family, your friends, your tribe, your nation, your species, and so on, and there's a kind of exponential drop-off of empathy, for better or for worse, as you go along there. I think if you can move up that curve by putting yourself into the friend pool and taking yourself out of the tribe pool or species pool, you can actually support yourself pretty well. Thank you so much for your kind attention. I'll be in the corridor.
We've been listening to the second half of the speech by science fiction author and e-rights activist Cory Doctorow, delivered on February 18, 2006 at the Boscone SFCon in Boston, Massachusetts. He spoke about the global legal and technological efforts to lock down digital rights and restrict personal and creative use of electronic materials. Cory contributes to the phenomenally entertaining blog Boing Boing at boingboing.net, writes for numerous publications, and is the former European Affairs Coordinator for the Electronic Freedom Foundation. He is now a fellow of the EFF. His most recent novel is Someone Comes to Town, Someone Leaves Town. Corey's website is craphound.com. You can download the first part of this speech from the Change Surfer radio page at iet.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future, brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy high tech and yet radically democratic future.